On this episode, you will learn when to purposely pay more tax. That might sound counterintuitive, but stay with us. We'll go into the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion, why your accountant might be giving you bad tax advice, and how to legally avoid capital gains taxes. As always, if this episode helps you or brings you value, please do me a favor, share it with a friend. Thank you and enjoy the show. Welcome to Build Your Wealth Muscle, a podcast dedicated to helping fitness entrepreneurs build wealth by saving taxes and growing their money. Each episode will break down different strategies in the areas of business, tax, and retirement planning specifically for your coaching business. Disclaimer, the topics covered in this podcast are for educational purposes only. This is not advice for your specific situation. Please consult a qualified financial or tax professional before making any changes to your financial or tax situation. Now, here's your host, certified financial planner and tax advisor, Pat Darby. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to Build Your Wealth Muscle. So today's episode is about essentially overpaying taxes. And that might sound insane. And for anyone who is potentially a socialist or disagrees with socialism, this is not that type of episode. That's not what I'm referring to. But I wanted to sensationalize the headline because I think everyone thinks of taxes, not everyone, but a lot of people, and this is a lot of even the accounting community, they look at taxes through a microscope, meaning they're looking at your tax liability right now. And that's not the best way to do it, in my opinion, because it's not just about saving taxes this year. It's about saving taxes over a lifetime. So the best example I can think of, and don't hold me to this because I was trying to do some research. I'm not a blacksmith, but to forge a spear, it takes, I found it ranges, I guess, like 1400 to 2000 degrees of heat. So essentially, it takes some pain to build a spearhead or like a sword or something like that that can do a lot of damage for you in a good way, but it takes heat and pain to get there. Tax planning can be a similar thing. And what I'm going to dive into today is essentially that, why you might want to put yourself through the short-term tax pain, aka paying more taxes today, for the outcome of paying less taxes over a lifetime and or someone else's lifetime if we're strategically putting those assets in a bucket where your heirs, your beneficiaries inherit them in a tax favorable position. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So again, the headline of purposely paying more tax is not to pay more taxes in general. It's putting yourself purposely through short-term pain for a longer-term benefit. And so this is why I have a lot of issue with some of the CPAs out there that I collaborate with for clients. Like, they're the client CPA, I'm the client's tax advisor, and they'll push back on me because I don't want to use a tax strategy to save dollars today, when in my opinion, we're putting the client through short-term pain for a better outcome later. So maybe another, using more of a medical analogy, if the tip of the spear analogy didn't work for you, it would be like ripping off the Band-Aid, or anything in the medical community, like pulling out a splinter. You know, like, that might hurt, but you need that out of there to get the long-term benefit. So we're going to break this down in a few different ways. And I want you to understand how tax planning really works. I've done obviously multiple, maybe not obviously, hopefully if you're a new listener, this is going to be helpful. And actually, for those who are new, I usually start with this. I forgot in this scenario, got all excited for my socialist headline. But we have two show formats. So there's today's episode, which is a solo, which is probably the majority of episodes that I do, where we can go really deep in areas of finance, tax, cash flow planning. And then there's other episodes. And again, in those solos, I want to make it extremely deep and informative and tactical for you so that you can DIY if you like to, or be really educated when you work with your tax advisor. The other episodes, we bring on guests, and they could be a colleague of yours in the online business space, or someone who supports your space like myself, or another tax professional or legal, insurance, whatever it is. They're helping support tax and finance. So anyway, let's get back to what I was saying. Sorry for those that are had already known that about the show, but I wanted to bring that up again. So in the areas of tax planning, it is really broken into different strategies. So first of all, when it comes to the taxes you pay, in today's episode, we're going to break down how we save self-employment taxes, income taxes, and capital gains taxes. So those are the three that we can really play around with for the most part. Obviously, there's other taxes in our lives, but those are the big ones that I specifically try to help as a tax advisor because we're looking at the business and your personal assets. So those tax buckets are in different areas. Then, so outside of the three types of taxes that we're strategically trying to reduce or eliminate, then there's types of tax strategies. So there's tax deferral, which you may be familiar with, where you just kick the can down the road. Like those would be your traditional 401ks, your traditional IRA, where you get a tax deduction, but you got to pay the piper eventually. That's in retirement. So you put the money in today, you get a tax deduction, you pull the money out when you're 60, 70, 80 years old, and you pay full tax, whatever the bracket is that you fall into with that year. So that's where a lot of the CPAs that I refer to, they sort of look at things through a microscope. That's where they love to live. It's like, hey, you made X this year. If we put Y into your retirement plan, you're going to get X dollars saved today. And then they do a victory lap, not taking into consideration that if you are a young individual in the middle of the tax brackets, and let's say you're, I don't know, in the 24% tax bracket right now, and based on the trajectory of your business, maybe you will max out the tax brackets soon enough in the next coming years. You know, it may not be favorable to take that tax deduction now. It's not doing as much for you. So that's where I'm going with that. So that's tax deferral. Again, you get the tax deduction now, and then you pay when the money comes out in retirement. Then there's tax avoidance. That's where you don't pay the tax at all. So one of the common examples of that is when business owners switch to an S-corp, because the type of tax there, like we said, there's self-employment taxes, income taxes, and capital gains taxes. We are avoiding a portion of the self-employment taxes. We're avoiding it completely. There's no deferral of it. If someone, maybe someone's self-employment taxes were going to be 30 grand and we drop it down to 20 grand, that $10,000 in taxes is gone forever. That's your money to keep. You kept $10,000 more that, you know, hopefully you turn that into an asset, but that is legal tax avoidance. And then that gets us to basically the third category, which isn't really a category. It's tax evasion. It's fraud. It's illegal. That's what we are not doing. And that's examples of like purposely not reporting your income. So for anyone out there getting paid cash and you're like, oh, the IRS doesn't know, or they're getting Cash App, Venmo on the personal side, and you're like, well, the IRS won't know. They may or may not catch you, but that is tax evasion. Same thing with miscategorizing expenses that weren't really expenses. You're paying less taxes. That shit's illegal, and we're not talking about that. That's not tax planning when you're just defrauding what you owe. Now, like I said in the beginning, I am all for capitalism. I am anti-socialism. I think we should pay as little as possible legally. Again, I don't want to pay a single penny more than I have to, and I don't agree, and not trying to get all political, but I don't think that the IRS or the Congress, whoever, you know, obviously the IRS gets a bad rap, but they're just really the enforcement arm of Congress and the Treasury Department. But I don't think they do a good job with our money. So that's why I am so passionate whenever I'm talking about this stuff, is I try to pay as little as possible for me, for my clients, for everybody who asks me or wants my help, because I would rather keep my business, keep my money with me as a business owner and my assets, and you as a business owner and your future assets and your current assets, because that's really what drives the economy, is you keeping an extra dollar or thousand or million and then hiring more people, buying more properties, which then in turn give place to sleep and shelter for other people. So that's where I want my money to go. Like, if I just use the most basic example, would I want $1 billion dropped in the lap of an entrepreneur like Elon Musk, or $1 billion dropped in the lap of Nancy Pelosi, and be like, okay, both of you, create jobs and spur the economy? Who do you think is going to actually turn that billion into jobs, and who's going to turn that billion into zero or negative? So that's where I'm going with that. So again, the deferral strategies. So let me back up again. And I want this episode to be, it's not going to be a lot of detailed planning tips, but I want the gears turning for everyone listening, because I talk about tax planning a lot, but I wanted to do a whole episode on why we do this. And it gets back to the original point, is that for a lot of the best tax strategies, it requires crossing that pain threshold of paying the tax. Because at some point, a lot of these strategies require that. So when it comes to the tax avoidance, oftentimes you have to pay the tax once. And that when you want to do that is when it's going to be as little as possible. So when we're talking about avoidance strategies, because I already talked about the deferral strategies, those are pretty straightforward. And quite frankly, they're overused because they're so easy to do. Like, a financial advisor, a CPA can quickly take a victory lap because they can look at your business, you had $200,000 of profit, they give you a deferral strategy, and then this year they get to ring the register with you and be like, look what I saved you. When I tell you a strategy where you pay the tax today, you put it into a tax-free vehicle, meaning you pay the tax today, you don't pay again, I don't get to ring the register, because by the time that does what it is going to do, I might be long gone because maybe that asset didn't get sold or transitioned for 50 years. But like the example of like a Peter Thiel, he invested in Facebook in his Roth IRA. So he put $500,000 in. Now, at some point he paid taxes to get that money in there. I don't know what his tax bracket was when he did so. But when it grew to whatever it is now, at one point it got famous because it had grown to $5 billion. He wouldn't pay taxes again on that if he started pulling it out. So that is legal tax avoidance, because he put the money in and all that gain would be considered a capital gain tax. But it's not applied to money once it's inside the Roth. So let's just say hypothetically that he was always a high earner. And when he put the money into the Roth, he paid max brackets. At the time, that could feel very painful. Maybe a tax advisor was like, what are you doing? Like, this is expensive. You're in the highest brackets. What are you doing? I'm sure he lived in California when he did this. Like, what are you doing? Then it turns into what it turned into in terms of a rate of return. That's when he can feel vindicated in that strategy. So let's talk about the avoidance strategies and then comparing income taxes and capital gains taxes. So now, income taxes are what you pay in your business or when you are a salaried employee for somebody. Admittedly, those are harder to block. You know, there's at least like legitimately, obviously we want to do things when we're blocking income strategies. That's when we're looking for like tax deductions in the business, tax credits in the business, finding every possible legal way to reduce the taxable income or the profit. So that's why, like, a perfect example would be if you wanted to go to Hawaii with your family, and obviously that would be an expensive personal expense. But you have clients in Hawaii, you booked collaboration events with vendors in Hawaii, you have your spouse in your board of advisors, your kids are doing some certain things, maybe they're old enough to be your videographer if you're going to do certain things. So now you found a legal way to make part of the hotel deductible, all the flights, some of the meals. So you just might have made a legal tax avoidance strategy because you maybe just took $20,000, which would have been a personal expense, and legitimately moved it into the business because that was a giant business trip, even though it involved the family, but you did all the things to dot the I's and cross the T's. Cool. That's one. But in general, when we're talking about the business, those are the types of things that you need to do for legal avoidance there. When it comes to capital gains, there's two types of capital gains tax. There's short-term capital gains tax and long-term capital gains tax. Now, most people, most investors, this is a capital gains tax is essentially, for simplicity purposes, is applied to an investment. So a simple example of like stocks and bonds. You buy a stock, let's say it's $1,000. It goes to $10,000 a week later. You sell it. You made $9,000 in profit. That's a short-term capital gain. So even though it's an investment, it's taxed at whatever your income tax bracket is that year. So let's hypothetically say these are high earners. So you're in the top 37% bracket. That's what you get hit with on that $9,000. Okay. Let's say the same exact investment. We're just going to change the time horizon. You bought it for $1,000, and in a year and a day from now, it went to $10,000. Now, obviously, it could have done that right away, but let's say it went there and it stayed there and you didn't sell it for a year. Now, that same gain of $9,000 is called long-term capital gains. That's much more favorable because if you're maxing out your brackets on the income side, that went from 37% down to 20 because that's the max for capital gains taxes. So that's why when we're talking about assets, we can do legal avoidance of capital gains taxes by moving them into certain vehicles. What are those types of vehicles? The Roth IRA, the Roth 401k. Now, those are the ones that are on the more popular end for investment advisors, things like that. Now, there's other things that are pushed out there, like, and I've talked about a lot, like for instance, life insurance. If you're doing like cash value life insurance, I need to do a whole episode on this because I think there's times when it's applicable for people, and I think there's times when it's horrible for people. The challenge I have with cash value life insurance isn't actually with the product or the service, or yeah, let's say the product or the asset. It's the people selling it. The vast majority don't understand the other types of tools available. So they'll just tell you that this is the best way. And it may be for you, but there's a lot of scenarios where I think it's not the best. And so those are the things that people need to understand. Like, and that's the challenge with the industry as a whole is a lot of people who can make a lot of money with those because they do pay a lot to the people who sell them. Again, this is not, it's not as much a criticism on the investment as much as the people pushing them aren't always evaluating all your options. They're saying, yeah, this is, you're good enough for this, so you can afford it and I'll get paid. Goodbye. Versus, because of X, Y, and Z, this might not make sense for you. That's a bit of a side note, but I wanted to bring that up because on my social media, when I've got friends that do it, and we talk about these a lot because, again, they're well aware of the same thing in that it's not the asset that's horrible. It's most of the people selling it are pushing it to everybody, and that becomes horrible. So anyway, like I was saying before, we're still talking about legal avoidance of capital gains tax. Because that's where if you're reading like the Rich Dad, Poor Dad types of books where it's all about turning your cash flow into assets, and then obviously those assets could cash flow or they could just accumulate in value. Let's use real estate as an example because everyone is pretty familiar with it. It can increase in value basically two ways. It's paying you rent. So that's the cash flow that's increasing your money. And then the value of the property itself can go up. So those are the two ways that your asset levels go up in real estate. Now, when we're talking about the other side of that equation where the value is increasing, that would get into what like the short term or long term. So if you're a buy and hold real estate person, you're going to get hit with long term capital gains. If you're a flipper, then you're going to get hit with short term. Now, depending on if you're in the business of flipping, you might also trigger the self-employment taxes, but that's not where I'm going with this. But let's just assume we're talking about people who are flipping in 10 months, one property versus someone who's doing in 13 months. It's the short term versus long term. Now, if you're somebody who wants to do a 1031 exchange, that's a bit of a hybrid strategy because it is a deferral strategy and you can legally defer by rolling it into the next property, which is a 1031 exchange, and then rolling it again and again and again. And you can do that until you die. And then your heirs get a step up in basis. And so if you had a $100,000 property and then you've done this for 50 years, you keep 1031ing until that $100,000 property is a conglomeration of $10 million properties, that estate, that $10 million will get a step up in basis to $10 million and there won't be any capital gains taxes. So, but my point is, you have to realize that the person who did that strategy, that initial money they put into it, it's similar to the Roth IRA in that to get the money into their first property, assuming they did it with cash or the cash equivalent, that money was taxed by somebody. If it was gifted to you by family members, they pay taxes to give it to you. If you earned it from a job, you pay taxes to put that into your first down payment. The same way when someone like me says, hey, pay the tax to put it into a Roth IRA, or if an insurance person comes to you and say, hey, put the money into this IUL, all three of those, again, life insurance, Roth IRA, and real estate, you cross that tax barrier one time. Now, that's the key. You want to cross that barrier as minimal as possible. So if you're doing it just the one time, that's where you get into, like, again, you paid, but the legal avoidance is not on the income tax, because again, in that scenario, someone paid that income tax. It's in the next level, the capital gains tax. So when we're talking about purposely paying taxes, this is what we're referring to, that short-term pain, because you could be like, all right, well, I want to take a $50,000 tax deduction, but if you put $50,000 into a solo 401k regular, you'll get that. If you put the $50,000 into a Roth 401k, Roth solo 401k, you cross that threshold of short-term pain. But now, let's use the same asset class just to keep it simple. If it's a 1031 exchange versus a piece of real estate inside of a Roth IRA, sorry, every time you sell it, you're deferring the gains. Now, in this scenario I gave you, you can 1031 till you die, and then you can use tax-free money because you can take a loan out of it there. That's what the real estate people talk about. Same thing with life insurance. You take a loan out, and that debt doesn't trigger taxation. So, whereas in the Roth IRA world, if you are buying properties and selling them every so often, every few years, whatever the case may be, you're doing the same thing as a 1031, except you don't have the time pressure. And then you also have the ability to avoid capital gains. Now, the difference between 1031 and the Roth IRA, you have no restrictions after the year 59 and a half. So it's called 60. You can start pulling that money out. Versus in real estate, there's no age restriction. You can pull the money out, but you're doing it through a loan. So same thing with life insurance. The tax-free retirement is based on participation loans out of there. But when your life insurance policy grows in value, you already cross that tax pain threshold. So it can grow tax-free and you can pull the money out tax-free, again, via their debt instruments. But all of those three examples are helping you legally avoid those capital gains taxes and or like the cash flow if it's like a Roth IRA, things like that. So that's what you need to consider with all these interest, because again, let's go back to the famous example of Peter Thiel. If you are out here as an entrepreneur and you're very good at identifying an undervalued business, and you want to come in as a minority shareholder. I'm saying that on purpose, minority. Let's say you take 25%, something like that. I'm purposely using that number because if you take majority stake and you want to do this self-directing, like buy it with your Roth, you're creating challenges for yourself that I don't want to get into on today's episode because there's a lot of rules involved. But if you're just coming in as like a capital injection, you're like, oh, I want to take 25%. And maybe you're going to give them some strategic guidance, things like that. You can come in and do that with your Roth IRA. Again, let's say you have a friend who's got an amazing business model. They're great at sales. They're great at marketing, but they need $100,000 desperately for whatever reason. And you believe in them as an operator, but you have $100,000 in cash. You drop it into their business. If it goes to $10 million and they have an exit, well, then you're getting whatever your percentage of that, I guess, in that scenario, you would get $2.5 million because it went to 10 and you got a quarter of the business. You're going to have capital gains tax on that 2.5. Well, 2.4 in that scenario because you get your cost basis. But if you did the exact same thing in your Roth IRA, then you would get the 2.5 just drop back into your Roth and you would invest it again. You don't stop and pay taxes because you cross that threshold. So the other scenario or the example that I like to give, it's when do you want to pay taxes? On the seed or the tree? So you can pay the taxes. And now I like that scenario or that metaphor because it gives people the idea of like when I say the seed, I'm talking about when we are in this tax bracket, because you might be listening to this and be like, I'm already at the 37% tax bracket. Like, why would I want to do this? Now, you may not. Like, there are, like, this is not cut and dry for certain people, because I'll give you an example. I have clients that we're talking different strategies like Roth conversions and all these things to push the money into that legal avoidance on capital gains, tax-free retirement type of gig. But they're like, well, I'm in California and I'm probably going to move to Florida, or I might move to Nevada or Texas or whatever. It's like, okay, well, let's potentially hold off then, because we don't need to trigger a state taxation if you're going to, and that could be as high as 13% if you're in California listening to this, versus someone who's like, oh yeah, in 2 years, I'm going to be down in Texas. It's like, okay, well then this strategy might not be as applicable for you because you're about to save 13% by waiting. So let me be clear and disclaim, this is not advice for your specific situation, but more importantly, when you get pushback from your accountant saying that you should be doing tax deferred everything because in retirement you're going to have no money, who the hell's plan is that? They want to make a shitload of money when they're young and then have no money in retirement, have no income because so you're living on Social Security. Like, where'd all your assets go? That's not realistic. People want to have all these assets build up and giving them as low of income as possible. So if that's coming out of Roth IRAs, if that's coming out of loans from life insurance policies, if that's coming out of refinancing cash outs from real estate properties, those are the types of things people are talking about. When they have assets, they're continuing to grow in value, but your income, you've legally moved it to a lower tax situation. So that's the main thing I want to talk about today. Why you would purposely put yourself through that pain, because there's strategic places to put the money that you're legally avoiding. In this instance, capital gains, the main one I focus on today. Now, that's why I'm not saying in these scenarios where if you're making $1 million a year, you just avoid tax strategies and you plunk the money into your checking or savings account, because you didn't do anything tax favorable in the future. If you just paid a bunch of taxes and now the money just sitting in a vehicle that has no way to defer or avoid capital gains. Now, again, when I say the real estate, you can defer forever. So that's why it's kind of nice. You can't defer forever in a 401k. Eventually, you have to pay the taxes. And if you don't, your heirs will. They'll get the money. That's not the situation with the real estate or Roth or the cash value life insurance. So hopefully this is helpful. If it wasn't and you have questions, DM me on Instagram at the Pat Darby. I love this stuff and I'm passionate about it, again, because I get pushback a lot from people's accountants that all they do is file taxes. They don't lift their head up and look out into the future. So they're obsessed with being like, hey, good news, I saved you $5,000 today. Who gives a shit if that money could have gone into some sort of tax favorable instrument where now you could invest that money for the next few decades? And the last thing I should say, I forgot to say this earlier And I do agree with what I'm about to say. Obviously, I agree with myself. But the one thing we should talk about, and I don't have the numbers. I've talked about on other podcasts. So now I'm going off of memory. In 1981, the tax bracket for people making, I believe it was $200,000 back then. I forget what the number would be adjusted for inflation. But I think it was, I don't know, $600,000 or $700,000. I forget. Let's see if I can quickly look this up. Okay. So I found it. In 1981, if you were making $108,000, which when I wrote this a year ago, that was the present day equivalent. Now, obviously, inflation's gone crazy, but that was the present day equivalent of, like, let's call it $340,000, $350,000. So if you're making $350,000 in 1981, your tax bracket federally was 70%. So if you are making $350,000 in that scenario, every dollar over that, you get 30 cents on a dollar. And again, that's just federal. If you're in a high tax state, whatever. Today, that same person making that money is paying 37%. So that's the other reason why I push back against accountants who are fixated on, hey, my client is in the top tax bracket. This isn't favorable for them. I get it, but I don't have a crystal ball. But we are in fairly low federal tax brackets, historically speaking. And you guys all see how they're spending money. If our tax brackets go up in the future, then you will have been happy that even at the top brackets, you paid it now. It's not inconceivable. I'll go back another 20 years from then, 1963, depending on how old you are listening to this, that might feel like forever ago. And I wasn't born yet. So, I mean, it is a long time ago. But if you made $200,000 in 1963, now this inflates pretty high. It basically inflates to like 1.8, 1.9 million. But let's say you're out here listening and you're like, I make 2 million a year. Awesome. That's amazing. But in 1963, if you did that, you would have paid, you ready? 91% tax bracket. Now, that's not 91% on all your money, but every dollar over that 200K or the present day equivalent of like 1.8, 1.9, somewhere in that ballpark, if every dollar you make over that, 9 cents is for you. So if you're sitting there with, in 1963, with a business that was making, again, I'm just going to use the present day numbers to make it more reasonable for everybody. If you're out here right now with a $2 million business and you're like in profit, and you want to take that to $3 million in profit, in that tax code of 1963, that $1 million that you generate of profit, $90,000 goes to your pocket. The rest goes to Uncle Sam. So you have to ask yourself, how many business owners would be too excited? Because you know, as a business owner, if you're making $2 million in profit, how many dollars of revenue do you have? So if you wanted to add $1 million worth of profit, how many dollars of revenue would that take? How many employees? How many headaches? So I'm just saying that to say that in the past, and not like forever ago, the tax rates were egregiously high. I don't know if they're going to go back there, but the devil you know, there's a lot of potential for strategic planning, being like, even if you're right now making $2 million a year listening to this, being like, shit, I'm maxing out all my brackets. Maybe I should take some tax deductions. I'm not saying take none of those. There's ways to have hybrid strategies where you take some deductions and some pay it and move it into something that I just described over the last 35 minutes. But I just want to emphasize that all these accountants out there and tax financial advisors that are being like, take the deduction today and have an awesome tax-free retirement. You don't know. What if the tax brackets are back to 60, 70% for high earners? Again, no one here listening is like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if I have no income in retirement? It'd be cool if that income was tax-free, but no one's looking to make $500,000 or $1 million a year in their business and then retire and everything dries up from it. Like, maybe you want it to dry out from a tax perspective, but not from a real cash flow perspective. So hopefully that's helpful. And again, I really want to do a deep dive, giving multiple metaphors, multiple examples of why This is what tax planning is, people. It is not saying, let me save taxes today. It's saying, let me look out there and see if there's ways to purposely pay one tax to strategically avoid a bigger tax in the future. So again, hopefully that's helpful. As always, DM me, reach out, and happy to help all you guys. All right. Have a great week. Thank you for joining us this week on Build Your Wealth Muscle. The links mentioned in this episode are available in the show notes. For video clips and more information on tax and retirement strategies for fitness entrepreneurs, please follow my Instagram at ThePatDarby. If you found value in this episode, please do us a favor and share with a friend. If you tag me, that'd be appreciated also. Lastly, for help implementing any of the topics discussed, please book a call. The link is also in the show notes. Thank you again for listening and have a great day.